We're at Harvard University in William James Hall in the office of Steven Pinker. Hi, Steve. I wanted to talk to you today about the role of the scientist as a communicator. And the reason I'm talking about that is the inaugural address of President Obama, followed by his presentation at the National Academies of Science. He talked about restoring science to its rightful place. And I'm trying to find out by asking a number of smart people what we think those coordinates are. Where is the rightful place? What is the rightful place?
Well, I think the rightful place of science is not as just another interest group or another constituency, some kind of priesthood of people who portray themselves as doing something fundamentally different from what journalists or intelligent, responsible people do. Science, in my view, is just continuous with knowledge, with rationality, with trying to figure out how the world works. Science concentrates on some aspects of reality, tries to achieve knowledge about it that's as solid as possible, but ultimately what science does is not different from what anyone else should be doing, including politicians, namely trying to figure out what kind of world we live in, what makes it tick, and make decisions based on our best understanding of the kind of world that we live in. So a real failure of understanding, and I don't know which side is to blame, that struck me was some congressional testimony in which scientists were talking about global warming, and a congressman said, "Oh, that's the kind of thing that you scientists always say." Now, something went deeply wrong in terms of the role of science in public discourse for him to blow off scientists as just another interest group. Because assuming that these scientists were doing their jobs halfway right, assuming that they were decent as opposed to awful scientists, what they were doing was presenting our species' best understanding of the world that we live in. Maybe they weren't communicating that. Maybe they were putting on white coats and disguising themselves as some kind of privileged oracle or priest. Maybe this congressman was just out of touch with what science is, but that's the problem that I hope that President Obama pointed toward a solution to.
Okay, so on the one hand, you were saying that, you know, scientists should not be a separate kind of group, not a priesthood. They should be doing the same job as everybody else in society. On the other hand, you just also said that they are practitioners of a craft which delivers a kind of privileged information.
Well,
the facts of the matter,
It oughtn't to be privileged in that you kind of hope that that's what journalists are interested in, what politicians are interested in. I mean, you can't run a country based on false premises. Otherwise, the effects of your policies will be the opposite of what you hope them to be. And ordinary citizens, we all want to know what's true and what's false, how things work, not how they don't work. I think that scientists, in order to reinforce that that's what science is all about, should, whenever they can, try to retrace the inferential steps that lead them to their conclusions. Not just we have announced or it's a consensus among scientists that the world is getting warmer and it's the fault of burning too many carbon fuels, but why that is compelling. What is the kind of evidence that leads a scientist to that conclusion so that people will see that this isn't just one voice, it isn't just two sides in a he said, she said debate, but that there were reasons that led the scientist to their conclusions, reasons that any intelligent person could reconstruct, at least in broad outline, to be persuaded or convinced.
Okay, so there was a report recently which I mentioned to you that came out, I think, in July or something by the Pew organization, a poll that they did. And usually these polls go and talk to the public and find out what the public knows, what it doesn't know. In this particular instance, they actually asked, did a public survey, they also surveyed in collaboration with the American Association for the Advancement of Science, the AAAS, Publishers of Science. They also surveyed some scientists as well. And the headline here says, "Public praises science, scientists fault public and media." And that's basically the case, that, you know, public love science, mm-hmm. got the usual things wrong, you know, about the sun going around the earth and all those sorts of things. But the scientists were pretty demeaning,
yeah,
to be honest, about, you know, public's understanding of so on. And I think Alan Leshner at the end, the CEO of the AAAS, said that one cannot just exhort. We all agree, you should agree with us. It's much more interactive process that's involved. It's time consuming, can be tedious, but it's very important. But there is obviously this disconnect.
I wonder how much of that is specific to the United States, and in particular specific to the public's reception of the theory of evolution. That has become such
and this is a poll, of course, in the 200th anniversary year of Darwin's.
Yeah, that's right.
So, sorry to interrupt.
So that's the issue in which the American public deviates the most from the populations of other industrialized countries, and also the one in which there's the sharpest disagreement, I suspect, with scientists. I think for reasons, many scientists diagnose this as a problem of scientific literacy, that if only people were better educated about the facts, they would not be misled by creationist pseudoscience. There may be something to that, although I suspect that the deeper problem is that people have moralized the issue, that a belief in creation people equate with either an allegiance to some kind of community that you grew up with, that you want to feel solidarity with, or even a code word for are you basically amoral, or do you believe that life is guided by moral values? And they blend the morality with the science. And I think that's what drives a lot of the hostility towards evolution in this country.
Yeah, I'm just looking at one of the problems for science. Scientists' views of problems for science. Number one, public does not know very much about science. Major problem, 85%.
Mm-hmm.
So if the public doesn't know very much about science, who's... burden is that? Let's not say whose fault is it.
Yes.
Let's say whose burden is it, whose challenge is it?
And
I think about this book just out by Randy Olson, who did the book, the movie Flock of Dodos. Its title is Don't Be Such a Scientist.
Yeah.
And its basic theme is, and he was a scientist, of course, and that became a filmmaker, that is there some way of conveying the information without being so geeky and condescending?
Well, certainly condescension is a problem. Is geekiness a problem? Maybe people like their scientists to be geeky.
Geeky's in at the moment.
There's a certain chic to that, and people, I don't know if people necessarily want scientists to be hipsters or even worse, faux hipsters.
Let's go with geek chic. Yeah. But let's deal with the condescending part.
So. Yeah, condescension is definitely not only is it not a winning, is it a losing PR strategy, but in some cases it may be wrong scientifically as a misdiagnosis of why people reject the lessons of science. It may not always be through scientific ignorance, but it may be because of the fusion in people's minds of certain scientific hypotheses with certain moral precepts. Because, you know, to be honest, there's a psychologist named Andrew Stolman, who did a thesis in this department, where he tried to assess the understanding of evolution among people who believed in the theory of evolution, you know, good guys like you know, our buddies, and found that the majority of people who were pro-Darwinian systematically misunderstood the theory. You give them questions as to how does Darwin's theory work, they give you the wrong answer. Yeah. So it isn't just ignorance versus knowledge. It's also affiliation with certain groups, and in a sense, it's an extension of the culture wars, the red state, blue state divide. And it would be, I think, shallow science on our part if we diagnose the problem as simply due to not enough information. Although surely more information is better, and surely clearer information is better. In particular, not just flooding people with conclusions or hitting them over the head with what scientists believe, but retracing the inferential steps. That is, why are scientists so convinced that Darwin's theory is true? It's not because, you know, you have your God, we have our God, Darwin's our God. That would be the worst way to convey it. It's rather, well, let's look at the fossil record. Let's look at how birds get to islands. Let's look at DNA. Let's look at embryos. This is the brief for evolution. It's interesting that only in the last year or two have we seen books that simply lay out the evidential case for evolution. Jerry Coyne, Richard Dawkins, Eugenie Scott have all come out with books that actually lay out the case, something that in all these years of books on evolution, no one had bothered to do. That is a positive sign. And likewise, in other debates such as global warming, the economy, health issues, to lay out the logic so that any curious person can then recreate in outline how scientists got to their conclusions. I think that would go part of the way toward remedying this gap.
Well, but then I take your point, but the trick is how do you package the information in a sense? You mentioned that Richard has a new book out, Richard Dawkins has a new book out. The Greatest Show on Earth, I think it's called.
Yes, that's right.
That has been reviewed by said same Randy Olson in, was it Nature or Science this week or a couple of weeks ago, in which he said, you know, when he does the evolution stuff, great, but there's a lot of God delusion stuff in there. And he finds that part of it shrill. So plainly, there's something great here when you don't do a straight science delivery. And I think your point about the moral aspects emerging must be right.
I think that's a large part of it. I mean, I think my own view is that often when scientists who make the case for atheism are called shrill, they often aren't that shrill. It's just right. That the message is so discordant with people's core beliefs that no matter how it was put, that's how it would come off. That's my view. A lot of things that aren't shrill are called shrill, yeah. I think. And it's not clear what to do about that. You can sugarcoat the message and say, well, you can believe in God after all, and in some conceptions of God, perhaps you can. But believing in a God who actually fashions organisms or who pushes DNA one way or another, if you let that in the door, you are failing to appreciate some of the beauty of the theory of evolution, which can account for design without a designer.
Yeah. And let's talk about education for a minute, science yeah. education. We arrived in Boston a couple of days ago. Here's a headline. Obama, this is about a recent speech, Obama ties education and innovation. He's speaking at the Hudson Valley Community College. By 2020, America will once again have the highest proportion of college graduates in the world. All right, so a push towards education, plainly restoring science to its rightful place, the importance of science education within that, since innovation is also being cited. So how does one sort of go about creating that kind of a package? And let me give you a metaphor at least here. The public television series I did some years ago called The Human Quest, there was a sequence in there where I got into a cab and drove around London looking for maps of the mind.
I remember that, yes.
And the reason I did that was that London cabbies have to pass a test called the knowledge.
The knowledge, yes.
In which they identify all these points of interest and so on. It's been my experience, and I experienced it yet again this morning coming to your office, that most cabbies in most cities in the world haven't the faintest idea where most stuff is. they are not required to have the knowledge, as London cabbies are. Mm-hmm. And my metaphor with that would be that if you want to have an informed decision, you want to make an informed decision about science, then you ought to have some basic understanding of the science involved. But the question is, what kind of knowledge? Is it meta-scientific knowledge? Is it knowledge about the science and societal effects? Or do you have to have some of these facts of the matter?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, you have to ask some of the facts of the matter. And the debate as to whether one should teach scientific reasoning and critical thinking on the one hand or scientific knowledge and facts on the other is a pseudo-debate. You really can't have one without the other. And people should know basic things like how old is the Earth, how did life arise, how did planets arise, but also how do you refine your own common sense reasoning in the direction of science? How do you evaluate a hypothesis that might be circular or unfalsifiable or empty? How do you, if you have an idea, how can you test it to see whether it's true or not? How can you avoid various kinds of fallacies? Just getting back also to your question of how we can have a society that harnesses its brain power more in the direction of innovation and constructive uses. I mean, part of it is expanding the base of the population that goes to universities. On the other hand, just expanding at the bottom end and having more people who are marginally qualified in universities than not, maybe that's a good idea. I don't think that's necessarily the answer. We have another problem, and that is that a large percentage of the people at the top end of ability are sucked into Wall Street and law, where they derive fancier and fancier financial derivatives or figure out cleverer and cleverer ways to sue people. And the prestige, the assurances of a stable lifestyle that would motivate more of these bright kids to become entrepreneurs, engineers, mm-hmm. scientists, people who help society make better stuff, cure more diseases, isn't there. I mean, I see this in my own students at Harvard, where these brilliant kids who could do anything can't resist the lure of an instant six-figure salary on Wall Street, where I think the results of the last couple few years have shown that something in the incentive structure has been misallocating our intellectual capital. There's too many IQ points going into Wall Street for the good of society and our collective good.
Yeah. The founder, director, creator, or whatever, and CEO of the XPRIZE.
Oh, yeah.
In fact, says that you get what you incentivize.
Yes, well, that's the basis of the free market, and somehow it's been there's been some kinds of skewing where the matching of intellectual capital with our society's challenges has been out of whack.
Yeah, in fact, I hope to talk to Peter Diamandis, who I just mentioned.
Oh yes, right.
About this, because I think there should be an XPRIZE for education.
Mm. Innovations in education.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. How that would look, I don't know, but
yeah. Another thing that I see, is that in the university education, science and scientific reasoning are really not as emphasized as they could be. And I saw that going through the reform process at Harvard when we revised the general education requirement of our students. And our students still can kind of squeak by with two science courses, one semester each over their entire career, and then one course in critical, analytical, or quantitative reasoning. There are many Ivy League universities in which you can get by with zero science courses. It's considered a hurdle, a nuisance requirement to get out of the way, and not yet integrated into the rest of college education, which is a huge missed opportunity, not only because all citizens should be scientifically literate, but because science, I think, has so much light to shed on every other field in the university. And this is an opportunity that people in the humanities and social sciences and arts are not yet capitalizing on, namely, the science of perception has enormous light to shed on visual arts and on music. Linguistics has a lot of insight to provide on literary studies and poetry. Moral psychology could illuminate justice and jurisprudence and political science. The wall between science and the rest of the curriculum, I think, is an antique. And given how enrollments in the humanities are plummeting nationwide, kids are going into business and studies instead, it might inject some more intellectual excitement into the humanities if it was better integrated with the sciences.
I note that this is the 50th anniversary year of also C.P. Snow's
Two Cultures. Yes,
Two Cultures.
Right.
And we also just came back from the Santa Fe Institute doing some conversations with Murray Gell-Mann and other people. But at the Santa Fe Institute, and somewhat of a fixture there, as he's been for a number of years, is Cormac McCarthy.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Extremely well-known American novelist, who's also extremely well-versed in science.
Uh-huh.
So those, yeah. I think, those barriers that you talk about need to go.
Yeah, I mean, it's not an imperialist exercise of science. On the contrary, it may be a kind of lifesaver for the humanities, which, by their own admission, are endangered within the university and society at large.
Let me suggest something to you that. I've claimed before in a conversation we've had that one of the great things about science is that it is storytelling. And there's an immediate reaction. People say, well, no, you can't just be storytelling. You have to have the facts and so on. But at its root, there's a storytelling aspect mm-hmm. to it. And part of the storytelling of science is the history of science, the great mm-hmm. achievements of that led to all these sort of things. Not the personalities, but the the personal narratives of their endeavors and their quest for knowledge, if you like. History of science is a large part of Harvard. This place has got an amazing history of science department. Yeah. The chair is Ann Harrington. You have Peter Gallison. You have Steve Shapin. Do you agree with me, first of all, that history of science is a good thing?
I think as a topic it is. I mean, I think there has been a somewhat adversarial stance toward science in the culture of academic history of science, that many historians of science see their role as a kind of debunking, as trying to show that scientists are just human, they're advancing the interests of their class, their gender, their race, they're just another culture with no particular claims to the truth. That's been kind of the religion of some academic history of science, unfortunately. But as a topic, I couldn't agree more. It's fascinating both in giving us insight as to pitfalls that we should avoid and where ideas came from, and also humanizing science, showing that this is a game that anyone can play.
Yeah. I mentioned Stephen Shapin. He's written extensively on these things. Yeah. Wonderful stories, wonderful books about the foundations of science or the foundation of the Royal Society, which will be 350 years ago next year. So there's this longest running business enterprise in science, it seems to me that. And he's written about Hooke and so on and so forth and Boyle. But he also has a new book out called The Scientific Life, A Moral History of a Late Modern Vocation.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to couple that thought to who scientists are now to another paper of Shapin's called, which is actually titled How to Be Anti-Scientific. And he lists a number of contentious or provocative meta-scientific claims, things like there's no such thing as a scientific method, modern science lives only in the day and for the day and therefore resembles much more a stock market speculation than a search for the truth about nature. New knowledge is not science until it's made social. These are the things that you hate, I know. An independent reality in the ordinary physical sense can neither be ascribed to the phenomena or the agencies of observation. Scientists do not find order in nature. They put it there, and so on and so forth. Modern physics is based on some intrinsic acts of faith. Scientific community's torrent of unsubstantiated just-so stories and so on and so forth. And then he pulls a little twist at the end and says, sorry, I've been kind of hoaxing you. These are all things that have been said by scientists. By, oddly enough, by Steve Weinberg, Jacob Bronowski, Dick Lewontin, and so on and so forth. So the sense of what science is, what it can do, what it ought to do, and so on, is still this contentious thing. And I think that the public perception is that it's supposed to deliver certitude, hence these relativistic issues that are going on here. But plainly, we know that it doesn't deliver certitude. You pick up the newspaper 2 days ago, recently, and you'll see some story about, well, sorry, the thing about the depression gene wasn't quite right.
Well, I mean, I don't think any scientist would say or claim that it delivers certitude, but it is designed to increase confidence. That's different from certitude. As evidence comes in, you revise your beliefs accordingly. But if we didn't have some kind of accumulation, if we didn't get a better and better picture of reality, albeit never certain, then there'd be no point in having science if it was just shifting fashion. That, I think, very much speaks against the scientific spirit. You've got to be careful about those quotes where scientists sound relativistic. Usually they do that when they're criticizing their opponents. It's a view that I call relativism for the other guy. Your views are shaped by society, etc. They never seem to apply that to their own views. While acknowledging that scientific conclusions, like any knowledge, is other than mathematical certainties, they're always tentative. They're always subject to revision. Nonetheless, we do get better and better at it. Our confidence in certain things does increase. Otherwise, there really would be no point.
Yeah. So your point reminds me of the famous scene from The Ascent of Man, where Bronowski is at the pool at Auschwitz and he's talking about the dangers of a quest for certainty.
Yes, ideologies that claim.
And he quotes Oliver Cromwell in the end, I beseech you
in the bowels of Christ.
Think it possible that you might be mistaken.
That's a terrific expression. And I think that I mean, I think scientists ought to hold two beliefs. There is a truth, and I don't know what it is. but you do your darndest to try to find out. It'll always be true that you won't know what it is, but you make your best case, and collectively we try to maximize our confidence.
So given that little conversation we've just had, do you want to revise in any way your statement about what the rightful place of science is?
Oh, no, I think science, and any person who is interested in the truth, which means any reasonable, rational person, ought to be seeking the best and truest understanding of the world attainable. I think science is simply the exercise of doing that with certain domains, like how the physical world works. I think it's continuous with every other attempt to ascertain the truth, and I think it ought to be respected for that reason.
During the formation of the Royal Society, which was 1660, as you know, around that time, there was some work being done by Oldenburg, who became the first secretary of the Royal Society and was responsible for the publication of Philosophical Transactions, which is a hugely important part of the whole enterprise, since it's a peer-reviewed journal, first real peer-reviewed journal. But he and a couple of other people, Samuel Hartlib, and a man called Hack on the other place, were known as intelligencers. Mm-hmm. There were the virtuosi, who were the sort of elite. There were the mechanics, as they were known at that time, who actually did the experimental work. It was not clear. Hooke was thought more of as being a mechanic than anything else, because he was great at doing experiments. Mm-hmm. And these other folks were called intelligencers, and they were building communities and networks of and about science. Oldenburg traveled a great deal on the continent and so on. I think of that there's a great need for the intelligencers right now, people who are doing some of the communication of science and so on. And I think of you as obviously a practitioner of science, but also you have a role as an evangelist in some sense and as a communicator, an intelligencer. Am I thrusting too much on your shoulders there?
It's certainly an aspiration. To share the excitement and the knowledge and the whole attitude of skepticism of received wisdom, attempts always to go deeper, understand more thoroughly. I mean, those are ideals that I think excite scientists and that ought to be shared together with our knowledge. And it's certainly something that I try to do.
There's something on the above the elevators as I come into the buildings, William James Hall. It's a quote of William James's. And it does seem to be relevant to this debate we had about science and its place in society. He says, the community stagnates without the impulse of the individual, and the impulse dies away without the sympathy of the community. And that does seem to me a very eloquent statement about a possible relationship between the scientific community and the larger community of which it is part.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm very proud to work in a building that has that as its motto, its reminder above the elevators every day. And William James is one of my heroes, so it's particularly pleasing. Yeah. But yeah, a community is, in some sense, it's an abstraction. It's a bunch of individuals, although the whole is clearly more than the sum of its parts. And science, above all, is an enterprise that tries to get this collectivity called the scientific community, or in fact the community at large, really, to understand things in a way that no individual person ever could. So when it comes to any, even a sub field of knowledge, you know, color vision or language development in children, there isn't one person who has all of the knowledge that we have. Science is done in the hopes that there'll be some greater collectivity. Science is a kind of a wiki where everyone makes a contribution and the whole thing kind of stands above and beyond the individual members. It's a curious thing that works so well that for any bit of knowledge that you seek to find, there won't necessarily be one person who knows it all, but amongst the community, both of living people and of written works, and now electronic works, it's more and more likely that the answer is in there somewhere. So we get smarter as a community, even if individually not no single one of us is anywhere near omniscient or even particularly smart.
Yeah. One last thought here, which is that, in pursuing these conversations that I have with, as you know, great many people across a great many disciplines, we're just doing something about aging, for example, mm-hmm. asking leading experimentalists and theorists in the field if there is a standard, if there is an agreed upon theory of aging, if we all agree that there's a natural cap on human our human life, lifespan, if there's a use-by date and so on. Mm-hmm. And the answers are all over the place. Mm-hmm. There's no generally agreed upon business there. If we talk about how scientific theories are approved by the community of scientists, you know, you can have the people who still think that Tom Kuhn had some validity, and there are these paradigm shifts, and suddenly the normal science shifts. There are people who use the phrase that you used about falsifiability, which comes from Karl Popper and so on, and the Popperian and Kuhnian views are frequently at odds. So I think the point I was making about the public perception of science is that if there is this apparent inchoateness, this mm-hmm. disarray, this, well, I don't know,
yeah,
why should we be expected to know what's going on as well if they don't?
Right. Well, you're getting a biased sample when you look at the frontiers of science, or the cutting edge. People are working on exactly the topics where we have the least certainty. Otherwise, there'd be no point in working on them. So when you look at the cutting edge, you're ignoring the kind of the heft of the back of the axe that of all of the knowledge that was controversial 50 years ago, but kind of have settled down since then.
There are a couple of books that have come out that have roughly the same title. One was by Ramoni Cajal, one was by Peter Medawar, mm-hmm. and they're both sort of advice to a young scientist.
Ah, yeah, right.
What would your advice to a young scientist be?
Know your own strengths and weaknesses. Study yourself, your history of what excites you, what you're really good at, and try to match yourself to some area of science or some niche that matches your own portfolio of talents. Science, blessedly, is an eclectic enterprise. There are some people who are wizards at experimentation, others who are modelers, others who are theoreticians. Scientists have to be able to do all of those to some extent, but the weightings of the different parts of the portfolio differ by field, by subfield, and by topic. Know what you're good at, what gets you out of bed in the morning with that sense of excitement, and try to match yourself to the sub-discipline where those gifts can best be put to use.
Now, did you follow your own advice?
Yeah, I did. I picked cognitive psychology, which is an empirical field, but one that probably has more theory than a lot of other fields in psychology, but isn't a purely theoretical enterprise either. And I consider myself someone interested both in theory and data, in cosmic questions like what is human nature, but also in nitty-gritty empirical questions like how do kids learn irregular verbs. And I picked a field in which I could put both of those interests to use.
Optimistic about the state of science at this point?
Absolutely. Yeah, extremely optimistic.
Steven Pinker, thanks very much.
Thanks, Roger.